You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 32. I'm excited about this podcast episode and glad to have you here with us. If you missed the last show, go back and check it out. In that one, I had a discussion with Jessica Parker about how to eat vegan and vegetarian in New Orleans. And I know, even if you're not an herbivore, you're going to find plenty for you in that show. As you guys know that have listened for a while, I certainly am a meat eater, and I really enjoyed a lot about the discussion. What I most liked was Jessica's energy. It caused me to think about places I might have skipped over otherwise. In any event, check it out. Today's show is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, City Park. The topic's so big, we're actually going to do it in two episodes. This first one's going to be all about the history of the park, and then next time we'll come back and talk about things to do in the park, though I'm sure there's going to be some crossover. For today's show, I'm joined by a New Orleanian by choice, which, as you know, if you've listened for a while, I love that. It's my birthright, but for a lot of people, it was a choice. He's the chief development officer and the public affairs director of City Park. Again, he came here 16, 18 years ago by choice.
Oh, longer than that. Longer I came here in 1980. Wow. So, yes, I've been here a while.
Not to date you too much, but he's Mr. John Hopper. So, John, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
I'm so happy to have you here. And like we were talking about offline, the park has just so much to offer. And there's such a rich history and has such a place in the history of New Orleans. And I thought that it would be a great opportunity for people to learn about the history. And then again, we'll talk about things to do later. But could you first maybe, most of our audience is not in New Orleans, so can we just sort of orient them physically where we are in the city with City Park?
Well, if you look at a map of the city of New Orleans, we're kind of right smack dab in the middle, between just south of Lake Pontchartrain and about 3 or 4 miles north of the downtown, the central business district. So we like to say we're the heart of New Orleans. 1,300 acres, one of the largest urban parks in the country.
And that's something that I think people don't realize. It's about twice the size of Central Park.
Yeah, Central Park is 854 acres. We're 1,300 acres. So we eat their lunch when it comes to size. They eat our lunch when it comes to anything that involves dollars.
And so that's good. I want to get into the history of the park, but that's maybe a good point. How does the park fund itself? Or how does the park get funding?
We're a very odd duck. It's New Orleans City Park. The city owns the land. Your viewers, they'll pick up that I'm also the fundraiser for the park. The city owns the land. I'm actually a state employee, as are all the employees. Our budget's about $16.5 million. We get about $2 million of that from the state. Everything else, we get zero operating dollars from the city of New Orleans. So one of our other taglines is the most entrepreneurial park in all of parkdom. So we have to raise 85-90% of that $16.5 million every year. So if you want to not come and visit New Orleans but send us a big fat check, feel free.
We're going to convince them to do both by the end of this show. So City Park, again, you mentioned it really is in the heart of the city. In fact, this area is called Mid-City. It's right up against Bayou St. John, which listeners know that bayou is integral to the history of the city.
Yes, and we have Bayou Metairie, which goes along the southern border of the park for about a mile, and it used to connect Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River. So if there's any geography buffs out there, the reason we have 800-year-old trees and the reasons that the Indians set up house in this part of the city is over the eons, the bayou would flood, the sediment would build up just like it used to along the Mississippi River. So there's a little ridge right along the southern part of the park that's a couple feet higher than the rest of the city.
And so for the native New Orleanians that are listening that, like me, don't pay attention to the compass, that's really the area between the lagoon and City Park Avenue, right?
Correct.
And so that's the oldest grove of trees in the park.
Yes, the oldest grove of mature live oaks, Quercus virginiana. The oldest are 650, 800 years old. They're absolutely magnificent. and they're built for hurricanes. They're low and squat to the ground. I mean, low, relatively speaking, sure. But they can be as wide or wider than they are tall. So they're kind of like a linebacker in his stance and, you know, bring it on, hurricanes. And even after Katrina, we lost a few thousand trees, but we lost very few mature live oaks.
And that part of the park, is that part? That's part of the oldest part of the park, I suppose, right?
Exactly.
And that part specifically, and we're going to get into all the details about the park and the geography, but that, again, we're talking about between the lagoon, which, as you'll hear in a bit, is behind the casino building. We'll come back to that, and City Park Avenue. It is almost like a magical place when you walk back there.
It is. I have about 80 favorite places in the park, but it is hard to walk through the grove of old ancient oaks and not be put into a good mood or not put yourself into a good mood. It's just beautiful, and almost all year long, there's at least some leaves,
yep.
Hence the name live oak. They're almost always green. This year, they had an abundance of acorns, so there's going to be oak trees sprouting up all over the park.
And one of the things about that area, so I spent a lot of time as a kid in that area, and now I have twin five-year-olds, so we spent a lot of time back there. One of the amazing things about those trees, and you mentioned it with the spread, is that often the tree branches come down to the ground. So it's a fabulous place for even little ones to climb. It's a beautiful place for photographs, family photos, wedding photos, all those sorts of things back there.
There are several rites of passage for kids in City Park. One of them is learning how to climb a tree.
That's right, without a doubt. So you mentioned, you know, probably the earliest inhabitants were the Native American Indians and along Bayou Metairie, you said, at that time. At what point, you know, in New Orleans, it's often known among people that have been here a long time as the Allard or the Allard Plantation, but really it predates even that a little bit, right?
Oh, yeah. And I don't know the exact date for the Indians. Sorry, sure. I'm not a historian, but in way back as far as, you know, 1699, that's when Bienville first came mm-hmm. to the city. And certainly the Indians were there and established long before that.
And then I assume that at some point there was probably a land grant. And then Allard either inherited it or he purchased the property at some point. Do you know?
Yes, the property was left it was Santiago Lorraine's leaves the property to his daughter, and his son-in-law was Jean Louis Allard. And so that's how it kind of passed down. So the first chunk of land that came to the park actually was from John McDonough.
Right.
And he gave it to the park in his will.
Okay.
There's also some McDonough legacy in Baltimore.
Right.
And so that was the first chunk of the park. About, I think, 150 acres, more or less. And then over the years, it's grown into what it is today.
So when McDonough gave the park to the city, I suppose, this was in the early to mid-1800s. But my recollection from my studies is that really it didn't become a park immediately.
No, I keep referring back to the Odd Duck. You know, it was kind of this, like, there's this group of citizens and they were kind of do-gooders and said, we need to do something out here. But there was never any money, so they were just kind of doing things. And then finally in 1854, they said, well, you guys seem to be doing a pretty good job of being do-gooders. Why don't you just run this park? So kind of it's like, be careful what you ask for. Be careful what you do, because somebody might say, just keep doing it. So they took the ball and ran with it. And like most of when people come to the park now, all throughout the park, they see all these big trees and everything. And they think it's always been like that. But most of the park, the top two thirds of it, it's about a mile wide and 3 miles long or tall. The top two thirds was all marsh and pasture. Hmm. There were very few trees at all. Even on Roosevelt Mall.
Right.
From the Works Progress Administration after the Depression, all those big trees, people see them and they think, oh, these are hundreds of years old. You know, they were planted in the 1930s.
Okay.
So we have the climate for trees.
Right. So that makes sense, too. So I've always known the park entrance as being on the bayou side. But in fact, the original entrance to the park was on what we now know as City Park Avenue. And if you think of it that way as a tall park, as opposed to the way I was thinking of it coming in the wide side, then that makes sense. You hit the oldest grove of oak trees, and as you would progress towards the lake, then they're progressively smaller.
Exactly.
And that makes sense, as we'll get to in a little bit, that there are golf courses on that end of the park, and the trees are not small, but smaller.
Exactly.
The other thing that I thought was interesting, so again, for New Orleanians, I wonder how many people knew that, that was the original entrance, which is now where Ralph's on the Park is, was like a coffee house. And as I was doing research, that's back in like the 1860s. That's a pretty early structure.
It is, and some of the houses just on either side of where Ralph's on the Park is now, they're very, very old.
So that's pretty neat. So the next time you're in the park, if you go down City Park Avenue and look at Ralph's on the Park, that the building that it's in, I think, dates to the 1860s or so, and that was the entrance. There's a real nice arch there.
The Pizzotti Gate.
Thank you.
Which spells out City Park.
And that's a beautiful, the ironwork and the details in it. But I didn't realize until recently that that was the entrance to the park.
You bet.
So that's pretty neat. So McDonough gives the property to New Orleans. Of course, when we finally decide to make it a park, it's right before the Civil War. I imagine that that must disrupt us a bit. And then it's not really until the late 1800s that we decide to get serious about making it a public grounds again. Is that right?
Yeah, and we went through several fits and starts.
Okay.
And one of the very interesting things for historians, and watch our website, because historically, the archives, the minutes of the board meetings have been taken in great detail. Wow. These days, most boards say, you know, finance committee and met and discussed finance. Our minutes are just like a history book when you open it up. And in the early years, they're all handwritten. There used to be men that would go to school to learn how to, you know, calligraphy and everything. So it's beautiful. It's hard to read, but it's the handwriting is beautiful. And in great detail, you know, and very formal, on motion duly made by Commissioner so-and-so and seconded by Commissioner so-and-so, you know, it was agreed to buy 12 gray squirrels for $3.12. And back in the day, they always had the cents. They never rounded anything up or down. And so on one hand, it's just all these little nuggets. But then when you step back a little bit, it's really the history of our country, because World War One, World War Two, plagues, you know, the yellow fever, flu, racial tension, segregation, it all, everything that played out all around the country played out in the park also.
And can you find those minutes at NewOrleansCityPark.com?
You're going to be able to in the near future. We just, about 2 weeks ago, we got a grant, and so finally all of our archives are being digitized.
Nice.
They'll all be in a nice PDF, so you should be able to go to them and, you know, Civil War or yellow fever, and find information. As long as it doesn't go way back. Mm-hmm. Way back, you'll be able to read it, but you'll have to dig for it yourself. But amazing things. Like in the 60s, you know, the general manager of the park cited two beatniks down from the north, you know, and to keep a careful eye on them.
And we're going to circle back to beatniks a little bit later on in the show, I promise. But the other thing I want to mention before we sort of jump forward is, so that old grove, you know, there's certainly stories and accounts of there having been duels in the park. Is that where that would have taken place?
There, and the other entrance to, or the main entrance to the park these days, where you come in from the east towards the Museum of Art. Yeah, that's where gentlemen would settle their affairs of honor. And we have, I don't know, probably we have maybe 30, 40 named oak trees in the park for all sorts of different people.
Sure.
But there's quite a few that are named for duelists. And I didn't know until a few years ago. So they'd be down in the quarter. Somebody would, you know, impugn somebody's honor. They'd challenge them to a duel. They had probably had some Sazeracs. And so then they'd come and fight, because we were the outside, we were the boonies.
Sure,
so right, they'd come out here and get between the dueling oaks, one of which remains by the Museum of Art, and they'd do the deal. But it also, if you had enough money, then you had your butler, your second. So it could be that you challenged me to a duel, but I'm like, well, I'm not going to do that. I might die. So they'd wake up their second in the morning, the butler, and say, oh, and by the way, you know, at dawn or dusk, You're defending me.
Nice, nice.
So we have several trees that are named after duelists.
I did not know that.
Yes.
So you did mention the dueling oaks, right? There's only one left because one was felled by a hurricane many, many years ago.
Exactly.
But you can still see that. And you also hear, certainly in New Orleans, the suicide oak. Is that more of a legend, or do we really think that people hung themselves from that oak tree?
I kind of think it's more of a legend, yeah. But you know, it's kind of a sexy legend. So as long as no one thinks it's still real today and something that they should be doing, we right. can go with it.
Right. It's a fun tree to climb because it actually comes down pretty far. It's one of those with the branches. So then let's jump forward to some more pleasant topics. As we got into the late 1890s and then the early 1900s, it really becomes a park. And some of the things that intrigued me then are some of the structures from the early 1900s. If you could talk to the listeners a little bit about the peristyle and the carousel and those sorts of things.
So, yeah, we have the peristyle, which, see how descriptive I am. Think of like a Greek outdoor...
Like a colonnade?
Colonnade, yeah. I should know how many columns there are in it, but there's probably at least 40. So it's kind of just a big outdoor pavilion, but it's gorgeous. And so they would have recitals and bands play there, you know, like think John Philip Sousa, that kind of things. Weddings, kids would play there. They used to play hockey there with their roller skates on and everything. So we had that. We have the oldest antique carousel in the state of Louisiana. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's over 100 years old. I think this year, Pop Bandstand is 100 years old. So we have a lot of structures that date back well over a century.
And you know, they have such vivid memories in the lives of New Orleanians. So the peristyle, again, is sort of against Bayou Metairie, right?
Correct.
It's against the lagoon, and it's near a building we'll get to in a minute called the Old Casino. But then there's Pop's Bandstand right there. I can only imagine what it must have been like in the early 1900s. I can tell you as a kid, so around the peristyle, there's four lions.
Yes.
And that's another rite of passage. Actually, I need to put that on the list. My kids haven't done that yet, is to get your picture taken on the lion. Beautiful sunlight always coming through there between the columns and the lions and the water there and the oak trees. And then you mentioned Pop's Bandstand, which is small. But again, I imagine, and recently I've started to have concerts there.
And it's just going back to what used to happen. We have old great photographs of, you know, like I said, like, picture John Philip Sousa, and all the ladies are in white gloves sitting in little lawn chairs listening to the bands play, because that was a big night out.
Of course, sure.
At the carousel, and stop me if the story gets too long, there several years ago, somebody wanted to come because they were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary. And they met at the carousel. He was in the military. The lady was there with her girlfriend, and he invited her to ride on the carousel. It was a nickel. And so when they finished, he said, "Would you like to ride again?" So she turns to me and she goes, "I figured I had found myself a man with deep pockets, so I latched on to him." So, I mean, there are so many wonderful stories.
Oh, yeah. So that carousel we're talking about, it's part of Storyland, and we'll get to Storyland in a minute. But I read somewhere that, right, as you mentioned, the carousel horses, some of them date to the 1880s or 1900-ish. Absolutely beautiful. I think there's about 50, 55 horses there.
I'll take your word for it. I know there's.
I spent a lot of time in that carousel.
The vast majority are horses. I should know the exact number. And then there's a lion, a giraffe,
and a camel.
A camel, and maybe one other animal, and a few chariots that people can sit in. And what's distinct about it is it was actually two different wood carvers, Loof and Carmel, that carved the horses. So there's people that really know their carousel horses can see the distinction. They're just works of art. And I mean, they've just entertained people for ages.
So I remember riding as a young child, and now my kids delight in it. And one of the things that's different than the beautiful carousel at Audubon Park and the zoo there is this one's enclosed. So the carousel is in a, I guess, carousel building, you'd call it. But it gives it almost this otherworldly feel, because you're completely enclosed. There's windows, but it just has this magical when you step in there.
Oh, yeah, ask me. There are over 2,000 panes of glass in that building because after the hurricane, each one of them had to be re-caulked. But if you're a carousel connoisseur, I've learned that carousels are judged by the building, the actual horses, and then the band organ that plays the music inside. So the experts tell us that we're like an 8 or a 9. They say the really best, maybe I can't hardly believe this could be true, but that some of the best carousels are on the East Coast.
Well, as a parent, the criteria, according to the children, are do they go up and down really fast, and do they go around really fast, and are they pretty? So I have two girls. They meet all those criteria.
It moves faster than you would think.
It does, enough to generate a little bit of wind. So there's that. You know, it's just so beautiful. And those structures, kind of varied structures we're talking about, that date back, you know, again, over 100 years. And then I kind of want to talk about, you mentioned in passing a little bit, the impact of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, coming out of and in the Great Depression on the park. It seems to me that you can feel and see that throughout the park.
And interestingly, the park is kind of defined, I guess, by two events. One man-made and one nature-made. And so the first one being the Depression. And after the Depression and the Works Progress Administration, they sent about 20,000 people over the course of several years, about $12 million, which in that day was a lot of money. So when you go through the park, so that was the first really huge construction boom. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the roads, most of the bridges with the beautiful bas-reliefs, Tad Gormley Stadium, or what is now Tad Gormley Stadium, the original part of the Botanical Garden, just lots and lots of the park. Oh, and actually the digging of a lot of the lagoons. People see all these waterways. We have 11 miles of waterways. It's only Bayou Metairie at the very southern end of the park that was natural.
I didn't know that.
And part of the WPA, they had these huge steam shovels, and they kept breaking. And then some brain surgeon said, well, we've got all these guys that we're needing to work. Give them all a shovel. And literally, if your kids complain to you, tell them to shut up. Because half the lagoons in the park were dug by hand, guys with shovels.
Wow. And so you do see throughout the park, you mentioned the bas relief in the concrete. It's all over the place. It's on the bridges. It's underneath, actually, some of the benches, mm-hmm. I've noticed, in the Botanical Garden. Is that, you mentioned the Botanical Garden. Beautiful gardens here on the grounds of City Park. Were those created in that era, in the 1930s?
The WPA constructed at least part of some of the first parts of the Botanical Garden. And the artist during the WPA was Enrique Alferez. Legend has it, and I think it's true, because his daughter still lives here, that he definitely grew up in Mexico, and I've been told he was an aide to Pancho Villa. A character, I met him late in his life, but we now have the Enrique Alferez Sculpture Garden, presented by the Hellas Foundation in the Botanical Garden. So the foundation acquired a number of his works from his daughter. So now, instead of sculptures being spread out all over the park or all over the city, a lot of them are co-located in the Botanical Garden. It's really pretty.
Okay, that really explains, because I remember as a kid some of the sculptures that are no longer where they were.
Yes.
So they've sort of been organized into the Botanical Garden, which is a phenomenally, not only are the flowers beautiful and the sculptures beautiful, but the layout there. Again, it's yet another place in the park, we keep coming back to this, where you can just sort of get lost in time. It's peaceful. There's so much to see. The sculpture garden is just, I don't know how many sculptures there are, but it's phenomenal to wander through.
I think now there's about 16 or 17 sculptures all in one place. There's still several Enrique Alferez sculptures scattered throughout the park, and all the bridge reliefs.
Oh, sure. And they depict all sorts of things, but they depict a lot of industry and a lot of labor in this.
Yeah, you'll see the compass and everything that the engineers were using to lay things out and build things.
Yeah, it's a different style, but if you've ever been in the Library of Congress in D.C., it strikes me as similar to that. In one of the main rooms, there are cherubs around the top that represent industry.
Yeah,
and it's the same thing.
There's that, and then Enrique liked his women. I'll just leave it at that.
There are a lot of those. At some point, I'm going to put together a scavenger hunt, and that will certainly be on it, finding those things. You mentioned what we now know as Tad Gormley Stadium. It was built in the 30s as part of the WPA. It was City Park Stadium. And there are lots of those images of relief on the gates. But you mentioned Beatnik, and so maybe we'll mention that. One of the more famous things that happened in that stadium was a certain British group came to visit.
Yeah, it was 50 years ago, a couple of years ago, that the Beatles were here. Beatles came to play. And there's still, it's one of those things where, you know, it's every person of a certain age
went
throughout
Woodstock,
the entire country, they went and saw the Beatles. And I guarantee you, not all of them did. But so much time has passed, I think everybody can lay claim to it. But I know it was a weeknight. I've met some people that did go. And, you know, there were a lot of girls that wanted to go, and it was a school night, and so some mothers brought their kids, and others couldn't go, and they snuck out of the house. It was just, by all measures, it sounded like it was
so
crazy.
It predated me, but I am a little bit of a Beatles nut. It was actually September 16th, 1964. The only reason I know that is I was born on September 16th, 1970. You can see a great video, WYES, the local public radio station, has a nice video. If you are a subscriber to them, if you sponsor them, I think that's one of the things you can get a DVD. But you can also see some quick excerpts on YouTube if you look for Beatles in New Orleans. And my understanding is the concert was only about a half an hour, and you essentially couldn't hear anything but the screaming of the girls.
Right, right.
Kind of a side note, Clarence Frogman Henry opened for the Beatles, New Orleans legend, and at least my understanding is that what the Beatles were most excited about was they got to meet Fats Domino.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you could win some trivia contests.
So I need to put that all together right in the contest. But, you know, so people talk about the Beatles, and for the Beatles, it was very much this New Orleans experience. So that's kind of a cool thing, and that happened in the park. The other thing is that that stadium has been a hub of high school sports, football largely, for many years, but also hosted an Olympic trials.
Yeah, 1980, I think it was. I think it was around 1980s.
Sure.
So yeah, the Olympic track trials were there, and we've had a papal conclave, Roy Rogers and Dale Evans selling war bonds, James Gang, James Brown, all sorts of concerts in there. And actually, this weekend, as we speak, it's the state track meet is here. So and right now, it's a crazy house over there.
I went to Brother Martin High School here and spent many afternoons running track there on the track. So again, and that's a legacy of the WPA. And you mentioned coming out of a disaster, but a really good thing happened in terms of the city and City Park. And as we'll get to in just a little bit, sort of history repeated itself with Katrina. But then we jump forward into the 50s, and that's when Storyland came about.
And Storyland has been reincarnated, I think, twice since it was originally came here.
Right?
And some of our board members, there's pictures of them with their families.
Really?
When they, little kids,
so Storyland,
first coming in. And so Storyland, it's a magical little place for kids. You know, fairy tales come to life. You name the fairy tale, it's probably there. You know, the old lady in the shoe. The pumpkin, you can tell it's been a long time since kids have been around me.
Mother Goose.
Thank you. See, well, you've got them. You should be naming them.
So it is, it's hard to describe. It is really like a little amusement park. There are rides. There's a little roller coaster. There's bumper cars. Right now, my kids are fascinated with the little planes that go around the circle and they go up and down. And the kids believe they're flying the planes.
Oh, I'm sorry. We've moved from Storyland now into the amusement park.
So let's stick with Storyland then. Moby, there's the whale from Pinocchio.
Right.
So that came about in the 50s.
Yes. And still, if you live in New Orleans for more than a couple of years and have kids, you've probably already count on both hands how many birthday parties you've been to, because every parent I've learned would prefer to have the birthday party anywhere besides their house. So it's like, let the park clean up.
And one side note I read about that in preparing to come see you is that Blaine Kern Sr., who is sort of Mr. Mardi Gras, created most of the floats that you've seen, or many of the floats, that he was responsible for building those original pieces of work.
I don't know if it was all of them, but I'm pretty sure it was the majority of them. So good old Blaine.
And another piece there, again, I just got way deep in the history. A local businessman, Harry Batt, helped fund that, right?
Yes. And his son, Jay Batt, is still on our board. He hasn't been the entire time, but he is, I should say, he is currently on our board. That. Yes.
And I guess, is it Brian Batt, probably Harry's grandson? Brian Batt, the actor in New York, I believe is Harry Batt's grandson.
Yeah, I might have skipped a generation. I'm now making Jay sound very old. Jay, if you're listening to this, my apologies. You're not that old.
But it's a beautiful place. It's a fun place. You are absolutely right. The generations of New Orleanians bring their kids there. It is a nice place for kids' birthday parties. I have been there once or seven times. And then I sort of preempted you in terms of then as you move into the amusement park.
Yeah, so it's kind of a turn-of-the-century amusement park. So we have a roller coaster and the carousel and some rides that actually go really fast and the iconic train that goes choo-choo chugging around 2 miles of the park. So it's not an amusement park on steroids and it's not Six Flags. But if you're a certain age and you get on the roller coaster, you think this is big, tall, fast, and I can't wait to get off.
Yeah, my
and,
kids.
And
are,
then all of a sudden you love it and you can't get the kids off of
my
it.
My kids are looking forward to being able to ride it.
To be tall enough.
Right. They've just gotten to go on the Ferris wheel for the first time. But it is, right. It's sort of a scaled down. I think your description's right. It's not Six Flags. It's sort of a scaled down version of it, which makes it very approachable for little kids and for families.
Right.
You can spend hours or you could spend an hour. And there are things for little kids and slightly bigger kids. And it really is, it's part of the fabric of so many New Orleanians have memories of it. You know, and maybe that's a good time to talk about, you mentioned, you know, the need to fundraise. And one of the terrific fundraisers in the park is Celebration in the Oaks.
So Celebration in the Oaks, big holiday light display. Every year from Thanksgiving through New Year's. And we put up, I don't know, million lights, 10 billion lights, a lot of lights, and a lot of handcrafted displays made by our own elves. We have guys that work full-time, year-round, building the displays. So we don't go to Lowe's and Home Depot or a magazine to buy our stuff. And so it when you see the displays and the animated things, you feel like you're in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. But in the amusement park and the botanical garden primarily, that's about 20-some acres, I think a little more than that, it's all open so you can go on a ride, you can see the lights, you see the Cajun Night Before Christmas, the poinsettia tree. And so it's yet another rite of passage. People have had for decades their pictures taken in front of Mr. Bingle or the poinsettia tree or you name it.
So Mr. Bingle, for new listeners, I've talked about it before, but it used to be a department store in Canal Street called Maison Blanche. And Maison Blanche had their own Christmas character. He was Mr. Bingle. He had he had an ice cream cone for a hat and a cherry for a nose and holly for wings. And you could have breakfast with Mr. Bingle, which we did as kids. But when Maison Blanche was later bought out and then went away, Mr. Bingle went away. And then City Park, I don't know how you guys did that, but brought Mr. Bingle back. And he's been a feature in Celebration in the Oaks for, gosh, many, many years now.
Yeah, the store gave him to us. And so now Mr. Bingle resides here and he gets marshmallows. That's his main diet. He eats marshmallows all year long. And everybody loves Mr. Bingle. There's a whole jingle if you want to Google that.
That's right.
I am going to be nice to your listeners and not sing, but there's a whole Mr. Jingle Bingle. Or a whole Mr. Bingle jingle.
He's certainly a part of Celebration in the Oaks. And you mentioned like the Cajun Night Before Christmas. One of the things I love is that it is a light display, but it has its New Orleans flair to it. It very much, you hear music in the background, you see Cajun themes and New Orleans themes, whether it's Mr. Bingle or it's alligators or it's Cajun culture. It feels like it's constantly growing. One of the things in relatively recent years is sort of the dripping icicles from one of the big oak trees there.
Yeah, the cascading snow tree or the dripping snow, whatever you want to call it. So, we're in competition with everybody else and just like TV shows and everything, department stores, you have to keep things current. You can't just keep rolling the same thing out year after year and expect the masses to come.
And again, I would imagine that's a big fundraiser for the park. You talked about you're also in charge of fundraising.
It generates about 13% of our operating revenue. So nobody watches the weather between Thanksgiving and New Year's closer than the employees at City Park. Because if we have a good celebration in the Oaks and the weather is nice, it makes the rest of the year much more manageable.
And certainly when I do part two of this and talk about things to do in the park, that's a definite. If you're here between, again, Thanksgiving and New Year's, it's a can't miss. It's fun for adults. It's a good date night. It's fun for kids. You can you mentioned a couple times riding the train. The train to me is one of the many treasures in the park. You can ride it during Celebration of the Oaks, but you can ride it all year long. And it's, you said it's about 2 miles. It goes through a pretty nice section of the park.
And it goes through the old Oak Grove that we talked about, past the Museum of Art, through part of the Botanical Garden. So it's fun. It's out there chugging along today.
And it's also neat with some of the birthday parties that I've been to. You can actually see the guys, the engineers, working on keeping it up and restoring it and all that sort of stuff. The other thing back there in Celebration of the Oaks is the little miniature train area.
Yeah, that's in the Botanical Garden.
Okay.
And it's, yeah, that is a miniature train on steroids.
Okay.
So there's, I don't know how many, 10, 12, 15 different trains, and I think it's G-Track, but don't ask me for sure. It's bigger than the little ones, but a lot of trains that have gone through New Orleans. There used to be the Smoky Mary,
right,
that went from downtown out to the lakefront.
Right out to Millenburg.
And you'll see one of the cars is like a jail. And so what used to happen, they'd go out there from downtown in the French Quarter, out to the lake, you know, swimming around, a few drinks would be had. And if some of the guys acted up too much, they'd throw them in the car that had the bars on it, and it's like, sleep it off. The train goes back at 5 o'clock at night, and we'll let you off when you get back downtown.
We actually did an episode called History of the Streetcar, and it started with the Smoky Mary and going out to Millenburg and that whole story. I think I've seen an early picture of City Park where they had an early version of a streetcar. I saw the initials on it were New Orleans Railroad and whatever company on the little tracks here. So that's interesting. But right, this miniature train we're talking about is a miniature train. You know, it's not one that you would ride. And again, in keeping with so much in the park, there's all these little New Orleans nuances. There's a little streetcar on it. I think there's some houses represented,
yes,
that are of the New Orleans style houses.
Exactly. Again, and you can learn a lot because most of the guys that run it are train buffs and volunteers. So if you either are curious or foolish enough to ask them a question, you will get an earful. They are wonderful men.
So I am not a train buff, but I wandered back there during a party one day, and it really is cool. It's sort of a great introduction to New Orleans, too, if you're back there. A couple of the things I wanted to talk about, the New Orleans Museum of Art. When did the museum come about? Do you know?
I do not know off the top of my head exactly when.
I know that it used to be called,
it was called the Delgado Museum. Exactly when it was built, I don't know.
And it's a beautiful. So one of the things that's interesting is when you come through that entrance to the park, which to me has always been the front entrance to the park, it's sort of, it reminds me of like a boulevard in Paris. I'm sure that was intentional.
Yeah, the alley of trees and crepe myrtles and live oaks now leading up to it. And as we all know, looking at my cheat sheet, December 16th, 1911,
oh, wow,
the Isaac Delgado Museum of Art is dedicated.
So it's a beautiful building, but it's had some incredible exhibits over the years. Anybody of my age in New Orleans will remember, I think it was 1977, the King Tut exhibit. And so it was the national exhibit that went around the country to just a couple places, I think, with all of the things that were, or a lot of things that were discovered when King Tut's tomb was open. But back then, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And what I remember most about it was that the street was painted like a Nile blue.
The Nile River, right, blue.
And you had to wait a long, at least it seemed like as a 7-year-old, a long time to get in.
I'm not 100% certain, but I'd be willing to bet that that's still kind of the blockbuster event.
It was a major event. And I mean, I was a kid, but I remember that. And then over the years, I've seen things like the Fabergé eggs. There was a great Claude Monet exhibit as well. And it has a wonderful permanent collection as well. You've mentioned a couple of times a sculpture garden, which is right kind of at the back of, behind the museum a little bit.
The Besthoff Sculpture Garden. And I like museums, and when I go to other cities, I usually go to the museums and sculpture gardens. And I would put the Best Off Sculpture Garden up against any other outdoor sculpture garden in the country. And not only for the quality of the sculpture that I'll let somebody else debate, but I know it's good. I mean, they've got Henry Morris, for crying out loud. But not only is the sculpture in Botero's, but the landscaping, the setting is gorgeous.
Yes.
Nothing against the mall in D.C., but the sculpture garden there, you know, it's just flat and has a fence around it. This has beautiful oak trees and pine trees and Mardi Gras beads hanging from the trees. I always tell people, if you're in a bad mood, go to the sculpture garden. You'll leave in a good mood.
It's so soothing, man.
And if you're in a good mood, go to the sculpture garden, and when you leave, you'll be over the moon.
And I think, you know, obviously what we're talking about is, generally speaking in this episode, the history. But we just keep talking about all these little pockets inside the park that each have their own character, their own little culture. You're right, the sculpture garden. I know nothing about sculpture. It is beautiful, but that setting really sets it apart, if you will.
Yes.
That is a place that if we have perhaps taken the children, we need to circle back to the casino for beignets, and they're a little wound up even after playing on the wonderful playground. We take them into the sculpture garden, and it is a soothing, they love the George Rodrigue, the three color, the tricolor. Mm-hmm. I'd say the blue dog, but there's also a yellow side and a red side to it. There's something about going in there that's it's a great place to read. It's a great place to just sort of relax.
To chill.
And before I forget, I do want to mention, so we talked about Pop's Bandstand, and right next to it is a building called the Casino, which now and for several years has housed the Morning Call. Wonderful place to get beignets and coffee if you want to get away from the craziness of the French Quarter. And particularly if you have kids, you can go eat the beignets and they can play on wonderful playground right next to it. But that building, it's called the Casino, but it was never a casino, was it?
It was never a casino. Pick a story. Who cares? One of the stories that I've heard is that it was maybe kind of a bastardization of casita, which in Spanish means little house. Not that it's really a little house either. But no, it was never a functioning casino, but it's, you know, still called the Little Casino
building. I always called it the casino building. And it's always been refreshments of one sort or another. A couple more things, if we could. Is the, and I'm going to slaughter the way to say this, but the
Couturier Forest, my favorite part of the park. Good way to almost finish up. So yeah, one of the unfortunate things in the park is that there is an interstate that runs through about the bottom third. We can thank the Eisenhower administration. It happened. It's here now. But when they built I-610 that cuts through the park, they took all the debris, the detritus, whatever, and hauled it all off and built Couturier, the mountain, which is now Laborde Mountain, 43 feet above sea level. For people from out of town, if they're not used to heights, you know, we recommend you get a Sherpa, or that you go up half and then get up early the next morning and summit to the top, because very few people can summit the whole 43 feet at one time. But it's our mountain. We love it.
That's probably the highest point in New Orleans.
It is the highest point in New Orleans. And if you've talked about Audubon Park before in the zoo, Audubon Zoo is wonderful. Make sure everybody knows I love everybody over there. But they have Monkey Hill that forever people have thought that was the highest point in town. It's not. We love Monkey Hill too, but Laborde Mountain is significantly taller.
And again, it feels like you're in just a completely different place. It's a forest.
It's a forest. It's 25 acres, wooded. We've planted thousands of trees just in the forest since the hurricane because it got pretty wiped out. But it is for birders, particularly in the spring and the fall. We're in the migratory path for the birds going to Central and South America. So they either stop here to get fat before they take off, or when they come back from across the Gulf, they stop here and load up. So if you're a birder, you can come to the forest in season and see 40 or 50 different species in one outing.
Wow. And one of the things that it strikes me post-Katrina, and I'm not sure if Katrina's really the marker for it, is the pelicans have returned.
The brown pelicans are out there. There's nothing more fun than watching a brown pelican dive for a fish and get some lunch in their bellies.
And I don't remember seeing that as a kid. And now you do see it. Again, I don't know, you know, if Katrina was the marker or not. You mentioned, and I want to be mindful of the time. I know you have a stop, and I'm keeping John between a 2-week vacation. So I appreciate the indulgence. Katrina obviously had a devastating effect on the park. How significant was that? How much did it damage?
Oh, it damaged outside of that little ridge where I said Bayou Metairie that didn't flood. Pretty much all the rest of the park did flood. And the farther north you went, the higher the water got, or the deeper the water got. So it was anywhere from a foot to 8 feet. This is a good circling back, being the most entrepreneurial park in all of Parkdom. We rely on the sun shining to pay the bills. And so all of a sudden, when you're closed and you don't have anything open, you can't pay the bills. I don't want this to be a sad thing, but it's reality.
Well, and there were 4 golf courses and a very popular golf driving range.
Right. So all that stuff closed down. We had 115 employees, and almost overnight went to 23. Mm. We couldn't make payroll. So it was a terrible time. But I think if you look up, pick themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, City Park comes up. If you look up making lemonade lemonade out of lemons, City Park comes up, because not only we, but the citizens here and businesses all over the country came to our aid. And we have, since that time and in conjunction with our master plan, we've raised about $125 million. So what you see, in a somewhat ironic way, the park would not look as good as it does today had it not been for Katrina. Back in the day, the park would not have looked and had all the building that was done had it not been for the Great Depression. I don't want to be around for the third thing. I'll be gone. and I hope it never happens. But twice in our history, great calamities have ended up being followed by a renaissance in the park. And that's what we've been through lately.
One, it strikes me that the park very much is sort of a microcosm of what happened in the city, where you had all these volunteers come in and you had the population. I think, like anything, you get used to what you have. And City Park, like we've talked about, so many memories for myself and so many New Orleanians, but you sort of just accept it. And then I think there was a real moment where it was, this is important. And I can remember, I wasn't here at the time, but I was back shortly thereafter. I can remember going to the driving range, which wasn't really open, except so many people were wanting to go. And I can remember hitting balls and then someone saying, well, okay, we have to stop and you have to go get the balls you just hit.
My boss loves telling that story.
We don't have any way to do it. And people did. Put down the golf clubs, walked out into the field, and you know, and you're sort of trained as a golfer, don't walk out into the field, and pick up the balls and put them in buckets so that the next person
can come. It's amazing the things that happened.
And I think that's a great sort of way to circle back and then end. We've mentioned a couple times, you know, I don't want this to necessarily be fundraising, but it's important. The city park is so vital to the city, and it's dependent upon resources. It's dependent on Celebration of the Oaks and the golf courses. And one of the things that strikes me as a New Orleanian post-Katrina is the park is as vibrant as it's ever been, you mentioned. So one golf course is open. I know another one is coming.
In late April of this year, we'll be opening up Bayou Oaks at City Park South Golf Course. Professional level, so you can come if you're a scratch golfer. You can come and have a really challenging game at a professional level field, and there's 5 tee boxes for every hole, so no matter how good you are, there's a tee box for you. Then we kind of have the every man, every woman's, you know, duffer golf course. But it's good, you're outside, you're exercising, you're enjoying nature, but it's also critical to our finances.
Sure. Another thing that's happened in the last couple of years as well is there's a miniature golf course right in the heart of, actually, I remember it as being the tennis courts. There are now tennis courts on another side near Marconi Drive. But there's like a putt, not putt-putt, but miniature golf right in the heart. And I learned through preparing that there used to be miniature golf here years ago.
Yeah, a lot of things. It's like, just stay around for a couple more decades and it will come back. Yeah, we've had miniature golf, I think, twice before in the park. So now we have City Putt, and you can come and do a little educating with your kids, because each Each hole is a sign. It's either a city in Louisiana or a street name in New Orleans, and it gives a little history lesson. So when your kids aren't even paying attention, you can still indoctrinate them and do some educating.
And it makes it really unique and fun. And I so appreciate your time and you doing this. I hope what you get as a listener is that this history, 150, 175 years of the ground where we happen to be sitting right now, started out as this sort of small donation, not small, but 100 acres, 150 acres, is now 1,300 acres, you said. And there's so much that we haven't touched on, but it has found a way to be a part of the city and to continue to evolve. I'm with you. I don't want to be here for the third disaster, but so much came after, really, if you go back, maybe there was three, the Civil War, and then after the Civil War, and then the WPA, and the Renaissance now post-Katrina. There's so much history and so much to look forward to as we move forward.
It's a beautiful park, and if you have been here, come back again. If you haven't, I can't imagine you coming out here and not passing a good time.
I appreciate it. And I'm going to put links so you can find the notes for today's show over at beyondbourbonst.com/32. I'll make sure to put links to all the opportunities to explore the park and maybe leave a little money here to help support the park. I really, really appreciate, John, you doing this today.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening, y'all. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have an idea for a future episode or you just want to reach out to me, my email is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. And as I mentioned at the start, the next episode is going to be part two about City Park, where we're going to dive into a bunch of things to do and a bunch of ways to explore the park. So we're also working on future stories about movies filmed in New Orleans, about the Storyville District, plus many more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.